cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Carol Messer, along with Shanali Bosak. Tim is out today. We did, Shanali, get through this week's inflation reports. We also had retail sales, consumer sentiment, a lot of things. And as we've been saying, the next focal point is really next week's Fed meeting.
Yeah, and until then, it's kind of a holding pattern, isn't it? Though we do know some things, inflation being a little hotter than expected across a few metrics.
Which we know the Fed cares about.
Absolutely. But also that some of the economic data is starting to weaken, which also is not weak enough, though, to justify not cutting rates.
Well, this is why it's like kind of difficult, I think, for investors to figure out it, which is why we lean on a couple of folks here at Bloomberg. Let's bring in Bloomberg News economics reporter Steve Matthews. He's out there in our Atlanta bureau, and Bloomberg News economics editor Molly Smith here in studio. Both of you writing about the Fed meeting and kind of the backdrop. Steve, I want to start with you. It is atop the most read on the Bloomberg on this Friday. It has been there all day about the Fed scene sticking with three cuts here in 2024. We get an update next week. Tell us about your thinking in the survey that you guys kind of came to this conclusion.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We had a survey of 49 economists, and it's a very close call. It's not an easy call at all, but a majority of them believe that the Fed will stick with three rate cuts in the dot plot in the summary of economic projections next week. More than a third say that they will shift to two. We had a bad inflation report in January. Just this past week, we had a bad CPI, worse than expected, and worse than expected PPI. All of that goes into the Fed's inflation measure, the PCE measure. So the thinking is that there will be at least, it will take just two of the 19 FOMC participants to change their view on dots, to shift from three cuts as being the median to two cuts being the median. And that could well jolt markets, because markets are really not looking for that. So it's a close call, and it's going to be really, really interesting.
Molly, let's bring you in here to talk about what it means for what comes next. Because even though people will be looking at that dot plot, what will Fed Chair Powell say? The reality is, between that FOMC meeting, the one we're having next week, and the next set of economic data before you have the potential set of cuts that you'll see, there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, and I don't think Powell is really going to give us a great idea of timing. It's all been so vague so far from him, from some other of the Fed speakers.
That we would get rate cuts this year.
Yes. I mean, look, we're right now at March 15th. There's a while to go to the end of the year. So, and I think if anything, more of what you hear that's a little bit more specific than this year is later this year, as in second half of this year. So I still think that, I mean, you obviously have next week being the upcoming Fed meeting. Not really a whole lot of people seeing May as likely for a starting point. June even less likely after this week. At that point, that gets you closer to July. And then September would be the next one. Then you're in the second half of the year. So still a very good
case. And
closer
to a presidential election.
Even more so.
Well, you know, Steve, I mean, when it comes down to the data points, right, not all data points are equal. And I know the Fed has a dual mandate, right? They're watching certainly the inflation rate. They're also watching unemployment. The labor market, maybe some softness a little bit, but it's still pretty tight. Inflation is what it's all about, right? And the Fed is going to be vigilant on that. And that's going to determine ultimately how many rate cuts they do when we get to the end of the year.
Yeah, really over the last year and a half, inflation has been basically the only thing they've been looking at. When they were raising rates, when they stopped, we've had basically good inflation reports until this year. And now that is slightly changing, though. In the last couple of months, the unemployment rate has ticked up to 3.9%. It's the highest in 2 years. You're seeing a little bit more balance in the discussion of different Fed officials. And those who are saying that they're going to stick with three rate cuts this year, many of them are pointing to what's happening with the labor market, that, you know, they may not want to change to two cuts because they want to have that option open to move relatively quickly if things get worse for the labor market.
Steve, what about the election? You know, Carol alluded to it a little bit here, but given how much pressure there is on the Fed to fight inflation, and inflation going into the election is still such a massive concern for so many Americans, wouldn't there be some pressure on the Fed here equally not to cut?
Well, the Fed, no doubt, is really, really focused on inflation. And you will hear words every time that Chair Powell speaks. He's going to say we're firmly committed to getting inflation back to the 2% target. And that is an overriding goal, and it causes pain for everyone. And he's going to say all of the right things to kind of express concern on inflation. So that is a factor. But the timing of meetings is also a factor. One of the leading economists, Vince Reinhardt, who used to work with the Fed, was making the point that in some ways it will be easier for the Fed to move in June than September. At one point he was forecasting the first move in September, now he's in June, because if you had your first move in September, which if you had two cuts, it might make sense to do September and December. If you were doing that, that would be like the last meeting before the presidential election. And do you really want to be cutting rates the last meeting before the presidential election? I mean, there would be lots of accusations. As much as the Fed is avowedly nonpartisan, there would be accusations that they were moving for political reasons. And they want to avoid that impression altogether.
Yeah, just to piggyback off of what Steve said there, that in addition to the Fed preaching that they are firmly committed to bring inflation to 2%, they will just as equally be preaching that they are an independent institution, that they are not political, and that they will not wade into politics whatsoever. So I kind of have a hard time seeing how you make, I think the argument could go either way. If you cut in June versus September, of like how that could be politically motivated in either way. I think there are a lot of ways to slice and dice that, but either way, they're going to be focused on inflation and what the data tells them.
Yeah, and I will say, in talking with a member of the White House economic team, we talked with Daniel Hornung, I had to remember his name, deputy director of the National Economic Council, yesterday. And when I asked him something about the 2% target, he's like, hey, we don't tell the Fed what to do. We stay away from that. Steve, having said that, you know, I think about when you're like driving on ice, and I'm not saying that this is kind of what the economic situation is, but you know how you tap the brakes so that, you know, could the Fed try and do something earlier rather than later, and then maybe leave it alone for a couple of months to give it some breathing room, just in case that there is, like you talked about, some signs of maybe some slowing down in the labor market, just to make sure we don't ultimately slide into some kind of significant downturn.
That is absolutely an option. You heard Vice Chair Jefferson in a recent speech before the Fed went into blackout say, you know, he referred back to the mid-1990s when Alan Greenspan had a rate cut and then paused for several meetings before resuming cuts. And, you know, he was kind of holding that out as, you know, one option that they could do. They could do a move and then hold on pause for a few meetings. And, you know, that is absolutely an option. And if they're not really sure or if they want to keep their options open, that would be a good way to do it.
Real quickly, Molly, 10 seconds. What would surprise you in terms of the Fed meeting next week?
Probably looking more at the outlook for their inflation projections. If they saw maybe mark those up a bit, wouldn't be surprised as much if maybe there were modifications to the growth forecast, but seeing changes to the inflation one, that would definitely be market moving.
That would certainly get the investors' attention. Steve, same thing, 10, 15 seconds to you. A big surprise would be what from the Fed next week?
If anyone dissents, I would be surprised because I think, you know, and talking about the Fed being non-political, I think this is a period of time when they want to be united. Some of them are appointed by Republicans, some by Democrats. Right. They want to show that they are non-political.
Don't they, at the end of the meeting, all the hands go in the middle of the table and they go, yay, all for one? No, they don't.
Kumbaya.
Do that. Kumbaya. Kumbaya. All right, guys, thanks so much. Have a great weekend. Molly Smith, economics editor at Bloomberg News here in studio. Steve Matthews, of course, our economics reporter at Bloomberg News out there in our Atlanta bureau.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Hey, our next guest says the alchemy of low rates is over. Feels like a very timely conversation considering we're getting ready for the next Fed meeting next week. Let's get to it. Jeff Klingelhofer is head of investments for Thornburg Investment Management. They've got some $44 billion in assets under management, joining Shanali and me here in studio. Welcome, welcome. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I feel like it's an environment, depending on the day, depending on the data points, kind of certainly shapes the mood of investors. A lot to digest. Is there a way that you sum up today's investment environment?
Yeah, I think honestly, the way I would sum it up is we are looking to the forward, looking for the Fed, right? We're looking to a lot of complacency in the market, a lot of uncertainty. The data tells us that unfortunately the consumer isn't nearly as strong as the data is telling us. They're taking on more debt, they're dipping into savings, they're defaulting on that additional debt. Yet here we have markets broadly.
Yeah.
Markets are very complacent. PE multiples looking forward are very high, right? Spreads on bonds are very, very tight. Earnings expectations run very high. So what I would say is it's not that I'm bearish. We're really, really struggling to square up what we're seeing in the data versus what markets are telling us.
You know, I think Wall Street does this thing. Big investors, they shrug off the pains in the consumer. But there is a point at which the real economy starts to meet the market. And where is that overlap?
Yeah, I mean, the way I would characterize it, there's been a bit of a runaway train recently in terms of sentiment to the positive side. And what I worry about as we start to see data points that continue to affirm the economy is slowing, higher rates are actually having an impact, that we may see the exact opposite and markets pull back. We'll be watching the Fed very closely next week, right? We've, in the face of a couple of very strong inflation prints, the market, the Fed is looking at the dot plot because the Fed tells us they're going to cut rates 3 times this year.
Right.
I continue to push back. They told us they were going to be very reactive on the way up. They needed to see inflation above 2% and they needed to think it was going to stay there, right? The famous transitory language. I worry even the Fed themselves, they might be making a policy mistake on the belief that they're going to cut rates in the face of this higher inflation in order to prevent that true slowdown.
So are you saying, because we've had like Torsten Slok of Apollo Management, we've all been talking about it, was the most read story in the Bloomberg, that we could maybe not get rate cuts this year? Maybe we shouldn't get rate cuts this year?
Yeah, I'd be a little bit hesitant to say we're not going to see a single rate cut. That's where I was leading into this. But in reality, the Fed is telling us they're probably going to cut rates. What I would discount is I don't think they're going to cut 3 times. I think a reasonable base case for my view is we'll probably get a single rate cut in recognition that inflation isn't running at 9%. It is coming down to 3.
Right.
But maybe they don't need to actually get to 2 in an incredibly fast way. So they're probably going to hold it there for a little bit longer and adjust their expectations higher.
Now, the other question is when. We've been talking kind of just before we got on air about how tomorrow is actually the second anniversary since the Fed began this Fed rate hiking yep. cycle. So how long before they begin the rate cutting one? Does it have to be after the election?
I don't think it has to be after the election. I mean, my base case would be towards the late summer. But what I would say is Wall Street, we on Wall Street made a mistake. On the back of a very fast, very high interest rate hiking cycle, it was reasonable to assume that those long and variable lags would be a little bit shorter than we're historically accustomed to. But history tells us it's about 2 years before higher rates actually start to have a bite. And to your point, here we sit 2 years later and it is having a bite. So I think it's around the corner. It is slow, but I think it's around the corner, right? Because we see every single day the data is coming in just slightly weaker than markets expect.
So make the connection between like an NVIDIA that's up 80% this year with like the stuff we're seeing on everyday Americans. What's the connection that maybe we should be making?
I don't know if we should be making a connection, and that's one of the challenges, right? We've got a very bifurcated market, a couple very large companies. The hype around AI are really what's driving the market higher. But the entirety of the rest of the S&P 500, right, the 493, if you will, they're struggling.
But we have seen a little bit of a broadening out.
We have. But just earlier this week, we saw a survey out of small businesses that suggests forward-looking hiring plans are coming down, and they're consistent with that slowdown. And so there is a very big disconnect. And even on some of the AI, we have concerns because they're spending a lot of money, historically a lot more than they have spent, and their return on that invested capital is coming down. So if Wall Street doesn't see that return pick up, right, I worry that that sentiment could soften there
so
as well.
So you know how there was a point in time where people looked at some of these big tech companies and almost saw them from as a haven here. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that same dynamic is starting to face the semiconductor stocks? Do you think that in some ways that if you believe that a job market is softening, or if you believe that there are some struggles in the broader environment, that there still would be investment potentially into AI? I mean, does that start to also drop off in a way that no longer justifies these valuations?
Well, what I'll say is I think semiconductors traditionally are actually a fairly cyclical investment, and they've bucked that trend because of the hype around AI, and every company in the world feels like they have to jump in, they have to play catch up. But I think just like the internet or just like robotics, right, AI is something that's going to really work to shape the world, not over the next 1 or 2 or 3 years. It's over the next decades to come.
The runway's longer.
So the cycle probably should be longer, but the hype has really moved forward at a very quick pace.
I'm going to ask a savage question here.
Go for it. Love the savage question.
The savage question is, if companies are investing in this environment where dollars are harder to come by, do they invest in AI or do they invest in the marginal job?
I think over time, it's going to have to move back towards that marginal job because, again, what we're not seeing is the return on invested capital. So there's a bit, just like in markets, there's that fear of missing out, FOMO. You have to rush in because it's worked across 2023 and 2024. I feel like companies are also playing that catch up. They hear their peers are investing in AI, and therefore they have to invest in AI, but that should change.
Do you invest in, is there an AI play that you guys have been investing in because you kind of have to, or your investors are asking you to?
It's less because of that, but what I would say is what we want to find is companies with very strong moats. And so in the face of all of this uncertainty, this data that suggests on one level the economy is doing well, GDP for instance, but then gross domestic income should say the same thing, but it says something very opposite. We're really focusing on companies that surround the moat around AI. So companies like SK Hynix, right, still involved in that cycle, but not wrapped up in nearly the same amount of hype and PE multiple.
Where else are you putting, would you commit new money in this environment as you lay it out?
Yeah, the biggest takeaway from what I'm talking with clients this week is that uncertainty is very high. It's not that I think we are heading into a recession. It's that the possibility when we look at data and we pair these disparate indicators, right? Things like the establishment survey versus the household survey say very, very different things.
We've talked a lot about the mixed data points that make it tough.
It's pullback. It's just you don't have to be investing in these runaway sectors in order to be involved in the markets. So fixed income continues to look tremendously interesting, right? Income opportunities across the globe are very high. Global dividend paying stocks look very attractive to us.
You still think so on fixed income with where spreads are today?
Less on spreads, but treasuries, right, and low 4% is still historically, at least over a reasonable history, the last 15, 20 years, is a very interesting starting place. But the reason why I think fixed income in particular is interesting is because we debate what the Fed is going to do. I don't think the next move is going to be a hike. It will be a cut. I do think it's much longer. But the beauty of it is central banks around the world can cut if we get that recession.
Wait, did he just say, I don't think the next move is going to be a hike? So is that even a possibility we should keep in our narrative?
I think it's absolutely, we need to keep it in our narrative, right? Central banks run a objective where they have to react to incoming data.
Right.
And the challenge is inflation has stopped falling, and if anything, it's actually started to reaccelerate in some sectors. So I think it's premature to talk about a hike, but it's not off the table.
Wow. Great conversation. Come back soon. Jeff Klingelhoffer, Head of Investments at Thornburg Investment Management, joining us in studio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We've been watching a few commodities in the mining space. This is prices for two of the world's most important mine commodities are diverging quickly, with copper rallying above $9,000 a ton as supply cuts into hits the market, and iron ore is sinking as demand headwinds mount as well. Copper, by the way, surging about 5% this week. And then in the iron ore market, you've got futures falling below $100 a ton for the first time in 7 months. This has to do with China investors betting that China's years-long property crisis will run through 2024, keeping a lid on demand. So we continue to see some pressure on that sector. We've got a great guest.
We sure do. And he's joining us from our Bloomberg News Bureau in Chicago, William Chin, Managing Director and Head of Commodities at Singapore-based exchange conglomerate SGX Group. Will, how are you? Welcome, and welcome to our Chicago Bureau, joining us from, you know, the U.S. Commodities center of the country, really.
I'm very well, thank you for having me. It's a huge delight to be in Chicago, which is really home to one of the earliest trading of commodities contracts.
How do you see the ability for SGX to really expand into different commodities markets and really build on the client base that you have trading commodities on your Singapore-based exchange?
You know, the nature of what we do in the Singapore Exchange is to be liquidity builders of key things, which represent seaborne flows of commodities going from west to east and east to west. In other words, point A to point B. So a lot of what we do is to mirror what's needed from a risk management perspective. Some of the things that we have done in the past would be stuff which is related to industrialization in Asia. So we've looked at iron ore, shipping is a key part of what we do. And recently we've been focusing on some of the newer trends in the markets, which includes things like cobalt and lithium, which are crucial in the energy transition story.
Well, and I am curious about China specifically. How do you think you guys can benefit specifically from the general loss of confidence in China? Singapore has long played on that, for example. People who want to bet on China but are too wary to really wade in. Is this good? Can you guys specifically benefit off that?
You know, the key role of an exchange is really very much a arbiter of a credible price. So in many ways, people are typically very surprised when we talk about Singapore being the reference price of commodity contracts, which are traded around the world. The very essence of the role we play is one of price discovery. In other words, consumers and producers would come to the SGX to look for a fair price. You know, what kind of determines the marginal demand and supply, which makes up the price that goes into physical contracts. So that's a price that that's a role that we play, and we play that whether prices are going up or whether prices are going down.
When you look at the macro environment right now, where do you think that there are commodities with the most promise, given where many global economies are now and demand that would drive interest in those areas? Do you think that there are certain things that you trade now that have a lot of upside room?
You know, I would love to talk about iron ore, because iron ore, and I really love the phrase that, you know, that you used at the very beginning of the program, which is the invasion of iron ore. It really very much mirrors the evolution of iron ore from a product. 14 years ago, there was no iron ore futures. And today, it's a product that's grown to one that's traded 4.5 billion tons of paper back in 2023. Now, this is a huge contract. It's grown. It's got a lot of potential to do a lot more. And a lot of that is mirroring the role of iron ore in the urbanization story. So while some quarters, some clans look at iron ore as a China reference because China is the world's largest producer of steel, urbanization is a global story. So that's one big thing, which is kind of evolving iron ore into a global story. We also talk about the key input of iron ore into the making of steel and steel is a key input into the energy transition story. So we see iron ore to be one which is growing and evolving into a global story.
But well, to kind of play off of, again, some of the uncertainty over in China specifically, I'm curious how you get more commodities companies, iron ore and others, to build up your their presence specifically on your exchange, on SGX. How do you do that?
So the typical client segment that we attract would be the physical hedges. So both iron ore producers, steel producers, they would come into the SGX for hedging purposes. Now the product itself is evolving into one from a hedging element to a trading element, mm-hmm. to now one of a financial element. In other words, iron ore is finding itself into the cornerstone of many global commodity portfolios. And a lot of that mirrors what we said just earlier around the role of iron ore evolving into one of a global commodity.
What about outside of iron ore? You were asking about commodities with upside risk, but what about those with downside risk? There are still a lot of recession fears baking through the economy, certainly in the United States, but other global economies giving global central bank rate hiking cycles. You think about next week alone, 40% of the world's GDP is expected to have a central bank meeting in which many will make a case for either keeping interest rates higher or lower. How will that macro backdrop that worries about a downturn impact certain commodities in your view?
You know, all of these macro developments will drive increased and enhanced volatility in prices in commodities. I think the world has seen since COVID and post-COVID that the way of doing business, which is just in time, just enough in the commodity supply chain, that is very susceptible to shocks in the market, whether it's macro policies, whether it's some of what you've mentioned with central bank moves in the market. But all of that would drive a lot more, usage and adoption of what commodities means from a risk management perspective. So we see a lot of use cases, like I've said, you know, both upside and downside. We see a lot of clients turning to the SGX for risk management services, whether this is in commodities, whether this is in equities, whether this is in FX. And that's rising across the board for us as we see enhanced volatility and uncertainty in the world.
What's your goal or what's your mission in terms of building up liquidity, right, on these exchanges? Like, this is all great, and you talk about the financialization of iron ore or others, or other commodities, if you will, or metal-based commodities. How do you, though, build up liquidity, which will bring in investors?
You know, I guess my mission kind of translates into one outcome, which is the pole vaulting of iron ore into the global class of key macro commodity contracts. So think copper, think crude oil. We think iron ore has a very big role to play as it continues to
financialize. Or lithium, is that also part of it, like a lithium contract?
We think lithium is interesting. It's certainly part of the energy transition story, and it will have a role to play. It's small in terms of how it kind of mirrors the physical market, but we think this will have a very big role to play in years to come.
All right, going to leave it on that note. Some interesting to something to think about, certainly against the macro backdrop of some of the trade that we've seen in both copper and also more specifically iron ore. Hey, Will, thank you so much. Thanks for stopping by our Chicago Bureau. Will Chin, he's Managing Director and Head of Commodities at SGX Group, joining us from our Chicago Bureau. It's kind of interesting, you know, just watching. It was funny and interesting to talk about China a little bit, the trade, because it does feel like for such a long time, economic news would come out of China specifically, impact the trade here. It feels like whether investors are wary of some of the data points or not trusting it or waiting for the government to do something that shakes it all up.
And then we have to remember those U.S. data points hit at 10 a.m. Eastern time often, so that changes the trade often, doesn't it?
That's a really good point. All right, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
There's stuff going on, certainly, in the crypto world every day. Bitcoin extending a retreat from its latest record high. This on an intensifying debate about whether the bull run in cryptocurrencies is evidence of speculative froth in global markets. Bitcoin roughly down about 7%, Shanali, in the past 2 days alone.
Yeah, it's interesting. That is some leverage popping out of the bubble, isn't it? But, you know, traders aren't the only ones that are impacted by the Bitcoin price. We are going to be joined now, right, by
great
Adam
guest.
Sullivan, who is a great guest right before the halving cycle, president and CEO of the small cap publicly held crypto mining firm Core Scientific. Core Scientific, of course, emerged from bankruptcy just earlier this year, kind of right in time for the halving. But when you think about the dynamics that are ahead of you now, what are you most concerned about in terms of getting the rewards from Bitcoin going from more than 6 Bitcoin per block to just over 3?
Yeah, I mean, so Core Scientific, we are the leader in Bitcoin mining from 2021 to 2023 in terms of Bitcoin's mined. We've mined more Bitcoin than any other publicly traded mining company in 2024. And so as we look towards the halving, for us, it's about maintaining and increasing our share of the total market. So today we've seen the total network exahash continue to increase, even through really 2023 when Bitcoin was pulling back. We didn't necessarily have a bull run. But now we're seeing Bitcoin price increase. And so the amount of exahash that's on the network, the compute applied to the network, has continued to increase going to the halving.
Just because the value has gone up.
Just because the value has gone up. So old equipment is actually turning back online to capture these higher Bitcoin prices.
Well, what does that mean for your input costs as well? The cost of all the things that you need to mine that Bitcoin in the first place.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily about the cost, it's about the difficulty. So the difficulty, every 2 weeks, Bitcoin resets how difficult it is to mine a Bitcoin. And so the difficulty has been increasing steadily over the course of the past, you know, 5-6 years, actually, for the entirety of Bitcoin's existence, but it's been increasing more rapidly in 2024, given the price run up.
I want to go back to halving, though. Can I? I just want to understand and make sure our audience does. So it happens every 4 years. So it means the amount you and other miners have right at this point, basically your validating blocks are cut in half. So how does that, doesn't that impact the top line, the revenue line?
Absolutely. It definitely does. But
okay.
People on the network
and
do turn off.
And the value of as Bitcoin goes up, that's also a factor. And that's a big factor.
Yeah, but once we get to the halving, part of the network will shut off because they become unprofitable to mine at those levels.
Okay.
And so we get an increasing share of the overall network post-halving.
When you say part of the network shuts off, do you mean that companies, rivals of yours, will face increased financial pressure?
Absolutely. In 2022, we saw the down Bitcoin price, you know, go into kind of a bear cycle. We saw energy prices go higher. And so what you saw was a number of challenged companies sell facilities, sell miners. And you'll see that again if that happened.
Adam, I mean, you're kind of a great person to talk to, given that Core Scientific faced bankruptcy once. Why is this time different for you guys? How did you emerge from bankruptcy and make it into this cycle?
Yeah, I mean, it was a 13-month process. And when we came out a much stronger company. So we had a much more interesting capital structure. We lowered our debt by almost 40%. And they gave us optionality in the capital
structure. About $400 million in debt that you guys trimmed?
Yeah, we trimmed about $400 million.
Yeah.
And so the rest of our capital structure has optionality in it, meaning there's mandatory converts in it. There's cash exercise warrants. And so if we perform well, it creates a situation where we'll be debt-free.
So what are some of the lessons learned from the first bull run we saw in crypto going into now the new bull run going into crypto into the halving?
Yeah, it's that Bitcoin mining is very much a commodity company, right? So it's you have energy inputs on one side and you have Bitcoin outputs on the other side. And you have to be able to hedge input costs and hedge output costs. And so, you know, we were a case study in, we had over $600 million of Bitcoin on balance sheet. And when Bitcoin started to trade down, it not only hurt our balance sheet, but our income statements started to get constrained as well. And so that was the real issue in 2022.
So your balance sheet is very different so that you can't get into that situation again? Like, go play it out for us a little bit more, because you are a great case study. I think if I'm an MBA student, I want to study your company and understand, you know, what happened and then how you came out and how you're doing something different. Because I could certainly see similar scenarios and troubles playing
history
out again.
History tends to repeat itself.
It does. But, you know, the interesting part is, our counterparties, our debt holders, understand that. And so they built two things into the capital structure, time and optionality. So the time is they bought us essentially 3 to 4 years before there's any larger maturity walls on our
debt. Which you didn't have last time.
Which we had a lot of short-term amortizing debt on the balance sheet before. And they also built us in optionality, where if we trade above certain levels, we are able to eliminate our debt. And so really those two things make us a completely different company from that perspective.
Now let's walk through some of the impacts of the halving. How much do you think it will impact revenue at the end of the day?
Yeah, it's a great question, because if you look back at the estimates in 2020, no one was right. And so when you look at 2024 and you look at the estimates, we have a feeling that anywhere between 10 to 15% of the network will come offline. So that means our revenues will be cut by about 40%. Now, depending on Bitcoin price, if that trades down, depending on the mix between machines at different power prices, more network exahash could come offline. And so we could have a better or worse scenario depending on those factors.
That's a big number. Is that manageable? Even with the covenants or whatever that you said that you guys are doing it differently in terms of how you're managing your balance sheet, that's a big hit. How do you manage that?
Yeah, you manage it through really three different areas, but one of the main ones is on the energy side. So you need to have flexibility and the ability to curtail more often on the grid because you get paid to curtail, or in some cases in regulated markets, it actually brings down your power costs. And so for us, as we look at cut, you know, the revenue cut, it actually provides an opportunity for us to showcase what we've built internally. We have the most advanced software team, the most advanced technology team, and the best operations team in the industry.
So you can automatically get those power benefits?
We can, yeah.
They're right there?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what about others here? I mean, I'm kind of curious about how you think the industry is changing.
Are you going to say Dogecoin? Are you going to go there?
Well, how do you react, right? How do you react? I was actually going to go to another buzzword.
Go there.
And
go
AI.
There.
Yeah.
And do you sit there as a Bitcoin mining firm and say we're going to diversify into other areas as well where certain hardware could be applicable? We've heard people talking about things like that. Do you buy some of your rivals at this point? How do you diversify or maybe double down on this industry?
Yeah, so we actually signed a contract, it was announced a few weeks ago, with CoreWeave, you know, a very large HPC company. That's really the first foray. You know, our company has traditional data center roots, and so we're looking at converting about 300 megawatts of our 724 megawatts today into actually HPC compute facilities. And so absolutely, we're taking a look at what it means in 2028 to be competitive and trying to work towards, you know, the infrastructure is a three-year game. So it's working towards altering our infrastructure before the next, you know, halving in 2028.
HPC, high performance computing.
Yes.
Okay, just want to make sure I understood it. Go.
I didn't know that.
Thank you, Google. Thank you, Google.
But, you know, when you're thinking about 2028 and you think about this halving cycle, even if halving cycles of the past had caused a run-up in Bitcoin or at least preceded one, how can you be sure that that will be the case for the future? As somebody who's running a business, do you almost have to protect yourself from maybe that not being the case every time?
This business is about protecting your downside risk and preparing for downside volatility. Because if you can have time and market in Bitcoin mining, you can actually experience the bull runs, which if you can't experience the bull runs, then, you know, Bitcoin mining is generally just, you know, for most of the time, Bitcoin is, you know, about a 30 to 40% margin business. But during bull runs, you know, the margin profile expands rapidly.
So are you set up? Okay, so we're just below $70,000 on Bitcoin. Are you okay with Bitcoin at 65,000?
Absolutely.
60,000.
Absolutely.
55,000.
Absolutely. We emerged at less than half of at 70,000.
So if there's some kind of significant haircut, you're fine.
Absolutely.
So when you're going back to the capital markets, right, I think one thing that fascinates me is that a lot of these big Bitcoin companies, and sorry, just about a minute to answer here, but these big companies are levering up again. Mm-hmm. Does that come with a warning sign?
It does a little bit. Absolutely. I mean, this industry is, you know, Bitcoin, especially the price, has been driven by leverage in the past. You know, we're seeing a little bit different Bitcoin price run up today, driven by ETFs. And I think that's actually a positive sign for our industry.
MicroStrategy.
What'd you say?
MicroStrategy just borrowed a ton of money to be buying Bitcoin. So leverage looks a little different in the system these days, I guess, than it had in the past.
Well, as you can see, we get pretty excited. I know you get really excited when we're talking about this topic. Adam, come back soon. Interesting. Yeah. Especially, it's a different year, a new year for you guys. So it'll be interesting to maybe catch up with you real soon.
Absolutely.
Again. Really appreciate it. Adam Sullivan, President and CEO. As we said, small cap, publicly held crypto mining firm Core Scientific. You can find it certainly. Ticker is CORZ.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, TikTok, everybody, just about 18 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the Friday trade and the week overall, and safe to say that we are so ready to do it. Let's bring in Nancy Tengler. Great to have her back. She's CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Laffer Tengler Investments, author of The Women's Guide to Successful Investing, with us from Scottsdale, Arizona. It is great to have you back. How are you?
I'm fine, Carol. How are you?
Doing well. Keeping up, getting ready for the Fed meeting next week. I am curious, you are there, before we get into that, because there's so much stuff that went on this week, but I am curious, when you are in and around Scottsdale, what is it that's top of mind for everybody? Is it the economy? Is it the election? Is it Fed talk? What is it?
Well, Carol, I wake up at 3:30 in the morning and I go home and go to bed at 6 o'clock at night.
So you don't talk to anybody.
I don't top of mind with too many people. But I think in our the circles that I do travel in, people will hear, of course, they're worried about immigration. But from an economic standpoint, they're just worried about inflation. I mean, only in our business will we talk about rate of change, it's coming down, but still, you know, costs in grocery stores are up 25%. And that's not the rate of change, right? I mean, that's there and it's hard to take away. I just wrote a piece on Walmart, but one of the things that struck me the last time I was there, I paid $7.20 at Walmart for a 64-ounce jug of Clorox bleach.
Wow.
Well, that's interesting.
$2.50 pre-pandemic.
Yeah, so. That inflation story too, we were kind of talking a little earlier about who it's impacting and who it's not impacting. And how do you think about that divergence in the economy right now and how that feeds through to the broader market?
Yeah, it always hurts the lower income cohort among us. And I grew up as a lower income cohort, and I grew up in the 70s when inflation was raging. And, you know, I babysat, I took care of people's dogs, I cleaned houses. You had to do that to make ends meet because my mom was a single parent. So I think that's what's so troubling. And now with gas edging back up and the PPIs pretty elevated, they led down. When the CPI started its descent from 9.2%, they started coming down in the spring of, was that last year or the year before? So I think the fact that the PPI came in so hot is at least giving some of us pause, because, you know, we may see a resurgence in inflation, and sticky inflation is still elevated in the 4.5% range.
Well, you know, Nancy, this is a question I asked Jeff Klingelhofer over at Thornburg Investment Management, who was with us on in the last hour. Like, that connection or disconnect, or how do you draw the line between some of the run-ups we've seen in the semi space, NVIDIA, other names, versus what's going on Main Street in real America, people paying $6-$7 for Clorox and other things. Like, that disconnect between people with household debt that has really raised to significant levels and is a burden, versus, again, the run-ups that we've seen in so many names.
Yeah, well, it's always been thus, unfortunately. But I think the one thing that's different this time than in the 70s is that people are still working.
Yeah.
And, you know, we saw the revisions to the jobs gains, but still, this is a healthy labor market, despite the fact that the labor force participation rate just doesn't seem to be able to get out of its own way. But I think, too, you know, I was looking at the NASDAQ, just like if you go back 2 years, so 22 and 23, it was down 3% cumulatively over that period. You go back 3 years, it's up 4%. So this notion that we're in a bubble, I just don't see it. As you know, we've talked about this. I've drawn an analogy to the 1990s. And this I think this is the playbook the Fed's going to use. You know, Greenspan raised rates aggressively in 94. And then he cut once in 95, sat there, and then cut twice in 96 and kept rates above 5.5% for the rest of the decade. Stocks still were able to coexist quite nicely with strong performance. I think that's the world we're in, unless something, you know, unless things fall off the rails. But Steel Dynamics reported today and they beat.
Right.
And, right. I mean, materially, a steel company, flat rolled steel. I mean, I own it. And I've been thinking about, geez, should I get out of this thing? But, you know, the industrial segment, manufacturing, is starting to turn. And I think that may be the next leg of this kind of rolling recession that's going to improve.
Go back.
So I'm still optimistic.
Go back, forgive me. You said the NASDAQ, if you go back a couple of years, you said, go back, because I'm just looking at the year performances on the NASDAQ. Make that point again for me.
Oh, yeah. So for 22 and 23, the cumulative return on the NASDAQ was negative 2.4%. If you go back 3 years, so this mm-hmm. would be 2021, 2022, 2023, we're up like 4%-ish. That's approximate. I wrote it down, but I don't know what I did with it. And so, you know, that's not a bubble. I mean, valuations are not crazy. Now, in some names they are, but in general, I think, you know, if you look at the Mag 7, the price earnings to growth rate mm-hmm. is 1.5 times, 2.5% for the rest of the market. So I think, you know, investors need to take a breath. We needed a correction. If this is it, I'm glad, because I'll be in buying some of the names like Adobe that got clobbered, or Palo Alto Networks.
Right.
We've been trimming all those mm-hmm. names. But this is an opportunity, because this bull market is not finished yet.
Hey, Nancy, what gives you conviction that we won't see a bigger correction?
More than 10%, Shanali?
Yeah, more than 10%.
I mean, I think we could tolerate 10 to 15. I don't think that's devastating, but I don't think we're going to go down into bear market territory. And the reason for that is that earnings are still pretty robust. So interest rates are not as high as they were in the 1990s. And, you know, the NASDAQ was up over 800% in the 90s. But more importantly, these are real businesses. You know, we're not valuing them on clicks and eyeballs. And so our investing theme has been, as we did in the 90s, ours has been old economy companies that are pivoting to digitization and cloud computing and robotics. So think Walmart or Xylem, a water treatment company. It's across all sectors. And then we like the suppliers of the picks and shovels. And those were the ones that were delivering really reliable earnings growth in the bear market of 2022. And so that's why we were in October, increasing our exposure to technology and consumer discretionary, because we felt like it had been way overdone. And indeed it was. And, you know, many of these companies actually benefited from higher interest rates because they have fortress balance sheets.
Right. Hey, Nancy, 30 seconds left here. My understanding, you know, you like those companies with reliable earnings. Microsoft is one of them. Just quick 20 seconds on Microsoft specifically, which, as we know, is up about 10-11% this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an extraordinarily well-managed company, and they are increasing the use cases for generative AI. It's going to be, you know, throughout the entire system, and I think that's going to continue to drive margins. It's not as fast of a grower as some of the other tech names that we own, but it's a reliable grower with a dividend that's growing, so that's what we like.
All right, going to leave it on that note. Hey, listen, have a great weekend. Try and get some sleep. Don't wake up that early on the weekend. Nancy Tangler, of course, CEO and Chief Investment Officer over at Laffer Tangler Investments, author of The Women's Guide to Successful Investing, joining us from Scottsdale, Arizona.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.